I would actually go up to the library on campus and I would just take my Nintendo and I just sit and just play games all day.
Mm.
And it was great. It was fantastic. It'd been what I've been waiting for my entire parental leave to be able to do. And I'm sitting here going, how the frick do other people find time with full-time work to be able to get into every freaking game that they do, man? Jesus.
Yep.
Like...
Well, there's really only one way, and that's to either have a spouse who's shouldering the majority of the load, yep. Or you're just a deadbeat parent.
I think that's a perfect... Hello and welcome to another episode of the Player 2 Pixelcast, episode 18. I am your host, Ken Lee, and joining me today are Sarah Ellen.
Good evening.
Hello, Sarah. It's been a while since we had you on the podcast.
I know. It's been an interesting few weeks, but it's good to be back and talking with friends.
Excellent. And another voice that we haven't heard in quite a while, Stephen Del Prado.
Howdy, howdy.
How are you doing, Stephen?
I'm good.
That's
busy,
good.
But good.
Yeah. No, notice that our answers tonight are really succinct.
Yeah, we're like, to the point, we'll get this done.
It's September, we're fine. I swear to God, we're fine.
Just please give me the next public holiday.
You guys get, hang on, do we get one?
Stephen, I don't know if
get,
you...
Stephen, do we get an October one, don't we?
Yep.
I think they moved the Queen's birthday to October. We didn't used to have one. It used to drive us nuts. But thankfully now, the Sunshine State...
It's a Monday.
Yeah, it's the first Monday in October or something.
Second Monday of October.
Cool.
I love a Monday long weekend, can I say? I prefer a Monday long weekend rather than a Friday long weekend.
Hmm.
Is that weird? Like, I prefer it if the holiday's on the Monday rather than a Friday.
Not weird. It everybody likes to lose a Monday because it always feels like the week has already started and you're kind of in the momentum. Mondays are always hard to start. When you kind of sit there and go, you know, you have your Friday off as a holiday, it still takes that Monday to rev up and you can't even lose a day there. So you're not really getting a full 4 days if you have a Monday to Thursday compared to a Tuesday to Friday that you'd have more likelihood of that happening.
Yeah.
Well, I have no idea what I just said.
No, it makes sense. I mean, if it makes sense for you, it makes sense for you. But I like it because, you know, I still get a long weekend, but it makes the following week shorter.
Yes. Yes.
I'm not picky, I'll take either.
Yeah. Well, we all, I mean, I think between the three of us, we all have children, so any type of holiday or break is always welcome. And on that note, I think Sarah's been playing something that's related to family and children.
Yes, I have. So I've been picking away slowly at Children of Morta, which is a new game that's come out by the Deadmate Studios, and it's published by 11-Bit Studios, also published, I think, that Moonlighter game that everybody had been raving on PC and the Switch, which was like that. You go through dungeons and collect stuff, but you're a shopkeep and you sell it to unsuspecting audience people in order to get some more money, in order to buy extra stuff, in order to go back into the dungeon. So we've talked about that before. Children of Morta is a little bit different, and I've been loving it. But that love has been kind of, it's been a little bit bittersweet for me because I love all the nice little neat ideas that they have in this game. So it is like an action kind of roguelike. Your characters will frequently die, as most roguelikes do. But you keep, I guess, the experience that you've gained. You keep, you know, any currency that you've obtained. And you keep any a whole lot of the skills that you've unlocked based on kind of when you level up. And you also unlock passive sort of skills that are shared amongst the whole family of characters, which is, and I guess that kind of gives context as to, well, it's the characters being a family gives a nice context to facilitate the mechanic. right?
Mm-hmm.
Which you could take or leave. This, you know, the story and the narrative is pretty stock standard. Giant apocalyptic thing is happening, and there are a band of heroes who need to go and fight the big, horrible, dastardly evil. And these heroes just happen to be a family of, you know, that are living in this house in, you know, in front of where the big calamity horribleness is happening. So it's a nice little narrative feel to it. Everything is narrated through kind of a third person narrator, so you don't get as much individual voice to it, and there's not individual voice acting to it. But what I've really struggled with is the game has all these wonderful mechanics in it. So the control style is delightfully not like Diablo 3. Which I say with happiness and sorrow in my heart. It has a nice kind of, you know, your WASD kind of move around mechanic. Your left click, right click does all your, you know, active skills in order to, you know, smashy, smashy, shooty, shooty, McLootie, McLootie. And there are other key maps on the keyboard that you use certain abilities for. The abilities are random drops in the dungeon. Oh. So, yeah, so you find relics that can be used repeatedly. You find charms that are sometimes only used once. And you find other little kind of passive artifacts or objects that kind you as you gain more, you kind of keep them as you go along. But they're all confined within that dungeon. So every dungeon run that you do, you may find a different relic or a different artifact that's going to change how you might play that particular level or that particular dungeon. And I love that. And similarly, I love the narrative. I love the art style, the music. It's great. It's great to have this in the context of family characters. The thing that I find difficult is when it's all put together, the pacing Fs up a little bit.
Okay.
So I guess every time your character dies and you get sent back to the house, which I guess is kind of like a hub to, you know, upgrade your gear or to unlock some additional things through a kind of a sage character, that sort of thing. It prompts a little kind of narrative short in a way. So like a little component of the story gets, you know, unlocked, and it doesn't make sense to me why it's getting unlocked at that point. It's like I could die three times and then a part of the story gets unlocked, and then I die the next time and then another part of the story unlocks. And it's just, it feels like the story is trying to keep going whilst I'm slowly chipping away at leveling up my character to be able to do anything. And so the pacing, because of that, feels weird. It doesn't mean that independently all these elements are great. It just feels weird putting them all together. And that might just be, I guess, a thing that's personally feeling a little bit offsetting to me. Yep. Or it could be something, I don't know if other people have identified something similar, but that's just where I've found a little bit of, I guess, tension between the pacing of the gameplay, which necessitates you slowly chipping away, and the narrative going, oh, please, you know, we need to show more of this narrative. We need to be exploring them more. We need to be, you know, continuing to remind the player of, you know, the level of tension and angst that they should be feeling. And it's like, but that doesn't make sense when I'm only getting through the same 33 enemies every time I go through this dungeon because I keep getting killed. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, no, yeah. It does. And it's sort of like, it sounds to me like the game is holding itself back. It wants you to do something, but it's at the same time not letting you do it.
It's got a wonderful array of amazing ideas, and each idea in its own right is fantastic, and everything is great, it's putting the ideas together that just hasn't entirely meshed well. If it was, it's either that there's a feeling that you need to keep reminding the player of the narrative in order to keep them engaged, but the gameplay should be keeping the player engaged. And it keeps me engaged. Like, I'm happy to go back into that dungeon and just keep dying over and over and over again. It's a roguelike, so what it's supposed to do. So that's where it feels like it's forcing a level of engagement that they don't necessarily need to force. So the question would be, would there be an ability to, you know, only bring those components up once you completed a certain level of that dungeon, and then, you know that it's been brought up based on your locality and what you've beaten rather than just that you've died for like the 87th time. Mm. So, you know, that is a component. And also the other thing is some of those, you know, deaths and random narrative spawns, if you will, are where certain key elements that make the game easier come in. So that's how the blacksmith gets unlocked, how the shopkeeps gets unlocked, is how the shrines within the game randomly get unlocked, which I'm kind of like, those should be, that, you know, if you want to do a narrative drop of them, fine, but that should have happened at death number 17, not death number 47. It's just kind of a bit, the logic behind it was a little bit jarring for me. And I kind of think that there might have been a better way to do that that was more measured, that would have made me appreciate, you know, the narrative more rather than feel like it was just a little bit getting in the way of my enjoyment of the game.
Yep.
And I didn't want it to, because the narrative's great and the art style is great and everything about all those things are great. So as I keep saying, each element is fantastic and I love it. Just, you know, it's like I can't cook for crap, and it just sounds like these people are having trouble kind of putting together what it is that they're actually creating in a big picture. So that's kind of the very succinct summary of what's going to be in my review of Children of Morta. I have played it on the PC, so I don't know what it would be like on console. I'd be interested to play it on the Switch, because I'm interested in playing everything on the Switch. So, you know, it might, I don't think it's going to change those elements. Might change some of the controls, which I'd be interested in too.
Yeah, well, that sounds... did you say you had a review going for onto the website
soon?
Yes,
I do. And it will be up, hopefully, before this podcast comes out. Because if not, I've just blown the entire review. But definitely, it will be on Player 2. Have a look at it. I will be far more succinct and maybe a little, maybe a fewer curse words in the review than what I've actually done in the podcast.
All right. Well, yeah. Fair enough.
I'll stay classy. Yeah.
I'm just going to do a hard segue because I can't think of a soft one. Stephen, you've been playing Control.
I have.
Sorry. No.
I guess I'm taking control of the podcast now. Okay. Yeah, I have. I just wrapped it up the other day. Well, the main story. I've still got a few side missions to mop up here and there, but yeah, it was. It wasn't really on my radar. Most Remedy stuff hasn't been, to be honest. Which I'm going to quickly remedy now. I'm just really thoroughly enjoying Control.
Okay, dad joke.
So I think
we're
I'll...
Done. We're done. You did it. It's fine.
Roll credits.
If we can just add, you know, the little drum beat in there for me, Ken, in post, that'd be marvelous. So I'm pretty much planning on going back and sampling Alan Wake, which I dabbled in but never really knuckled down and completed. And I'll probably give Quantum Break a go, even though I've heard that Quantum Break is not as polished as Control and it might be a little bit difficult to go back to, given that it seems to be playing around with some of the similar gameplay mechanics. But, I mean, it's, you know, it's free on Game Pass, so I'll give it a crack. But yeah, so Control wasn't on my radar at all until some of that really positive just prior to release, coverage started coming out, and Huso had sort of made some rumblings that he was really digging it. And then I looked a little bit more into it and thought, this actually might be right up my alley. So I decided to grab a copy, and, you know, I managed to pick it up for $68 on release day. So nice. I got stuck right in. And I think going in blind is probably the best way to go into Control because of sort of what they're doing. I don't want to really talk about the story too much because I think part of the story is what makes it such an enjoyable experience, the layers that sort of peeled back from it. But
I've been listening to other people talk about this game, and from what it sounds like, it's like Twin Peaks mixed with Men in Black mixed with...
It's kind X-Files. Of like the X-Files meets David Lynch with a little bit of, I guess, Infamous gameplay DNA in some ways. So, yeah, it's really cool. I'm actually looking forward to more content that Remedy have already promised into next year. So, they've got a few expansions they've planned, and one looks to really heavily tie the game into Alan Wake, which is, you know, done through some of the... I guess the notes and other artifacts that you can find throughout the game. But it's really cool that I guess Remedy got that IP back from Microsoft and have been able to resurrect it in such a, I guess, a way. Like, I wonder if Controls are going to end up being sort of like a backdoor pilot for Alan Wake 2 in some weird way. Like, that would be cool to see. I kind of got God of War vibes because that was another game that was absolutely not on my radar and ended up being one of my favorite games of that year, and I think Control is maybe going to end up the same way. It's one of those games that you play, and some games you stop playing and it doesn't really dwell on your mind, and you can quite happily go about your day, and then you come home and you're like, oh, yeah, I guess I'll keep playing that. But Control has sort of been dwelling on my mind, like, you want to explore more of the world and find out more of what's going on, and there's so much lore. It's overflowing with items and audio logs and videos and other things that sort of build upon the world they've created, because the location itself is fairly contained in a couple of ways, but just the hints that they drop at the wider world around it and some of the, I guess, the horror in the mundane is one of the main themes that they seem to be pulling from, you know, like... There's objects of power and artifacts in the world that are ordinary objects that have been imbued with sort of this otherworldly presence in some ways that then has unpredictable results. And it's, you know, the idea that you can be absolutely terrified of a pink flamingo that's going to create all sorts of catastrophes. I just kind of dig it. Like, I really vibed off that, and, you know, having all of these sorts of high security areas to lock up these very mundane objects because of what they can actually cause is just a really interesting idea. At least I thought it's, I don't know. It's just, I think everyone should give it a go, and it does have some rough edges. The map is freaking useless. Fortunately, in terms of just the design of the location, it feels like you're running around a giant office building in some respects, and then maintenance tunnels in other areas and things like that. But everything is pretty well signposted, so even though you want to throw the map in the bin, you can look at signs in the environment. They will point you in the right direction. And I think because it's a fairly contained area compared to, you know, a lot of open world games and things we're used to these days, you do get a bit of a feel for it, and you do start to be able to navigate your way around naturally once you spend a few hours in there. It doesn't overstay its welcome either. I think it's fairly succinct, and I've probably spent somewhere between 15 and 20 hours, and I've maybe only got another hour or two to go before I've wrapped everything up that's in there, and then I'd be waiting on some DLC content to get, I guess, more of
what are you playing it on? Oh, Pro. Because that was one of my questions, and I haven't looked into it myself, so maybe you know. I've got a PS4, just a regular vanilla PS4, and I've heard some mention that there are performance issues.
I have heard that as well, and I can say that in some particularly hairy areas, in even on the Pro, I have had some frame drops. So I can only imagine that is more affected on the, I guess, base PS4. I think it's one of the, and from what a general sentiment is that you can sort of push through that stuff. Remedy have just released a patch that addresses some frame rate issues, but I don't know how much of that trickles down to the base PS4. I know Huso played it on the Xbox One X, so obviously he was getting the best console experience available, but I think while there were some areas of slowdown on the Pro, I don't think it negatively impacted me as much as something like the map being fairly unintuitive did, or just some poor signposting in terms of what you should be doing at particular times. Like, if you're not sort of completely switched on in some parts, you can miss a lot of side quests until fairly late in the game when you are maybe desperate for the ability points and other things that completing those does. Because you've probably seen Jason and a few other people addressing it on social media, but I think part of probably the pacing and the poor signposting is mixed in with the fact that the difficulty spikes in control are a little bit weird. And if you're not, I guess, open to adapting your play style on the fly, you're going to find particular enemies extremely difficult. This is not a game that wants you to duck and cover and pick enemies off. It wants you to be getting into the thick of it, and you're rewarded for doing so in a lot of ways. The health system is not regenerative. You need to pick up health points from enemies you've downed, and that's basically the only way to do it in combat. So you need to be killing enemies and running out to their corpses to collect extra health. So if you're trying to really hide and pepper enemies, and they can just sort of, you know, death by a thousand cuts in some ways if you're not able to get out there and pick up some health. I didn't find it overly difficult. There are a few deaths here and there, but I was able to wrap my head around most of it. I think they do give you a robust array of weapons and abilities to tackle things. But again, if you're the sort of player who, you know, sets up your abilities or picks a particular weapon and that's me done for the rest of the game, you're probably going to struggle with some of the later enemies that really make you, I guess, use whole parts of the arsenal rather than just the one or two things you get at the start of the game that you might want to stick
with. Well, I'm super interested because I've always been a fan. I'm really quite a fan of Remedy's games. I've enjoyed the first Max Payne, the second one. I wasn't a fan of Max Payne 3 as much. But that was Rockstar.
I think that was Rockstar as well, wasn't it?
I really enjoyed Max Payne 1 and 2. I loved Alan Wake. That game used to terrify me.
I think if you loved Alan Wake, really then you're probably going to love Control, because the connection between those two has made me want to go back and love
Alan
Wake
so much. It's one of my favorite, all-time favorite games. It's just I mean, the thing I loved most about Alan Wake was the atmosphere. The atmosphere was just so oppressive and dark and terrifying. And every time I remember very distinctly when playing that game, whenever the dark clouds start to sort of build up and swell and you know you're about to attack, my hair would physically, like physiological response, my hair would stand up.
I think you're going to get a lot out of Control then, because it sounds like it trades off a lot of those same beats.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to, and I was saying to you and Sarah before we started the show, that I'm probably going to EB rent it, and which for international listeners, it just means you buy a game, play it, and then you return it within the return policy of EB Games. And this goes a little bit, I think, into our topic for this episode, which I just realized I didn't signpost what the topic for this episode was.
Well, it would be a real shame if they missed out on what the topic was.
Snap! Oh my god!
Well done there. So I'm just going to cut in a little bit. I just realized that we went straight to talk about games without me talking about what the topic's going to be. The topic's going to be a fear of missing out, FOMO. Games that we if the fear of missing out means that if you're not in there with the moment-to-moment beats of the latest and the greatest, you're just not part of the zeitgeist and not part of the conversation. And that's kind of with control that's happening with me. I'm like listening to people talk about it.
I'm the same. I'm hearing so much about control. And I'm like sitting and watching people and like, you know, Facebook feeds talking about it. I haven't had the time or the capacity to sit there and go, what, like, is this a multiplayer game? Is this one that, like, people are going around kind of shooting each other with weird blasty things? I have not had time to go to the Wikipedia and find out. So, but it's interesting when that happens.
I think you're probably okay, because in my mind, having wrapped it up and rolled credits and whatnot, I feel like it's probably the pinnacle of double A. It's not quite there as a triple A product, and it feels like it's cut a little bit short. I think we're really going to be getting the full Control experience once this season pass content
that
is
might
done
be
and dusted,
true, Stephen. But
next year,
you have no hot take ammunition if you're not there right at the start.
I guess you absolutely don't. But I think so much of Control, especially the storyline, because I guess that's one of the things, like, if it's not a multiplayer game where you need to be there day one to have extremely populated servers and whatnot, generally then it's story. We're worried about having a story spoiled for us. And I think the storyline and Control, a lot of it wouldn't make sense unless you'd gone through the whole thing. I think that's probably a strength of it. Like, it really builds upon itself towards the end. I felt the end was a little bit of a fizzer, personally, for me, but that's probably more to do with the fact that it does really feel like it's not going to be complete until we get the rest of this content. This feels like a really strong opening to something I'd love to see them expand on. Sort of like the way Rocksteady did from Arkham Asylum to Arkham City. Like, I feel like this could be Remedy's Arkham Asylum, and then I think they could do some really interesting stuff with it if they then kicked it up to the next level, if this is successful enough for them. You know, like if people buy it at full price instead of renting it for a week from
well,
EB Games.
I'm glad you brought up Arkham at that very end, because that ties into the game that I've been playing. And it does, again, sort of circle back round into our topic for this episode, which is, like I said earlier, FOMO. I've been playing Injustice 2, and that's a game that's been out since 2 years ago now, I think.
Yeah, I think it was. You're Googling, aren't you?
If you're hearing me tippity-tappity-tapping, that's
I'm
me Googling.
Than you.
May 11th, 2017. So absolutely just 2 years ago. And I picked up this game. Literally, I borrowed it from the library. Like, I went to the library yesterday to borrow Captain Marvel and Injustice 2.
Just so everybody knows, we all question whether or not he meant the library or if he meant the EB library. And he means an actual library. Yeah. So
the actual city council library just down the street from where I live. And I picked it up because I've always liked NetherRealm fighting games.
Yeah.
You know, they did a great job with Mortal Kombat 9, 10. They've done a great job with revitalizing the whole Mortal Kombat series, you know, with their whole the way that they approach single player campaign is just completely different. But one of my major issues with Mortal Kombat is that it's gotten to a stage where it's actually a bit too much for me now, in terms of the over-the-top graphic violence, hyper-violence. I think the most recent one, is it Mortal Kombat 11 right now?
Yeah, I think so.
I think so. Hard to play with kids.
Mortal Kombat 11, I can't play that with my kids around. I got to wait until they go to bed. But also, actually, me experiencing that now, I do feel kind of squeamish when I see the finishes and I see the the fatalities and that sort of thing, I'm like, it's just not my thing anymore. But I still enjoy playing their fighting games. So Injustice has always been that sort of, here's the other thing that they make, and it's really good. Although, you know, it's a fighting game, it's Injustice, it's got Batman, Superman, all the DC heroes. It's got this story where where Superman has gone down the path of being a despot and a tyrant, because he views that humanity is not able to look after itself, and therefore he, as the superhuman god, needs to be the paternalistic tyrant to teach us how to live in peace. And so Superman's done that, and Batman's, you know, just chafing at the bonds and fighting back, and that's why they're fighting each other. And it sets up this whole story where Wonder Woman's at odds with Flash, and Flash is gonna go punch down with Green Lantern, but at the same time they're gonna go fight Bane and Poison Ivy and all that sort of stuff. So it's this comic book story.
And it has a very good comic book tie-in. The comic book tie-in for Injustice was mad awesome.
Yeah, I've never actually read it. Have you read it?
Tom Taylor did it. He was an Australian comic writer.
Yes, Tom. Yeah.
So no. I read, I think, the first couple, and then a lot of them I gleaned through back when I used to subscribe for like Comixology, and I haven't read them in ages, but I read them as they went through. And no, it was... I like Tom's writing style, and that's why I liked it. But I mean, you don't need it to enjoy Injustice, you know. There's enough story beats in the game for you to feel like you're getting enough sense of a story in it. Yeah. If that kind of makes sense, yeah. And I agree with you. I have struggled with Mortal Kombat for the exact same reason, just because I don't like the blood and the gore. It just feels unnecessary, you know. It's not me being like a prude. It's not me sitting there and like going, oh, I'm so much, you know, superiorly better. I don't need it. And it seems like if it's hinging on a gimmick that I don't need, then I don't need the game.
And this is we're going back, it's a slightly different topic, but I've always enjoyed the Mortal Kombat lore. Like the whole like Sub-Zero versus Scorpion, you know, there's a little bit of thing there happening there. Johnny Cage with his sort of movie star stuff, and Liu Kang with his save the world type of, you know, there's this weird lore that I've actually kind of enjoyed.
Well, I enjoyed it when I was a kid. Like I remember reading it and thinking, wow, this is awesome. But you know, and I think I played it when I was what? I played it when I was 12. I probably shouldn't have, but whatever. But I played it on the Super Nintendo, so I got no gore. I like that whole kind of Scorpion Sub-Zero thing totally. It was, it had enough, it's same thing, had enough story beats to make it too
interesting.
Make it interesting, you know?
Yeah.
And
for me, when they rebooted Mortal Kombat in 2011, that's when they started with this particular style with the story. I thought that was actually really interesting that they interweave the story into the campaign, where cutscenes will take you from one fight to another and then switch up the different characters that you can use. So the story, you might be Sub-Zero in this little sequence, and you fight Scorpion, and then you defeat Scorpion, and then, you know, a new cutscene comes in and Liu Kang suddenly walks onto the scene with Raiden, and then suddenly you're in the fight. Like, there was a seamlessness to the cutscene sequence, to the fight, and then to the next cutscene sequence, and it mixed up the different characters, so you got a chance to give everybody a little bit of a taster. And I actually really like that structure as well. And it's just with the recent Mortal Kombat, I agree with you. Like the gore and the violence just became, and the blood just became hyper excessive, and just, and for me it became really unnecessary and irrelevant to the game.
Now, to my memory, Injustice does what like the first Injustice when I played it, did something similar to what you were saying. It was like the story components were seamlessly kind of brought in and then you went into a battle, but it contextualized why you were going into different characters, not just kind of having the one character and then kind of progressing up.
That's right, absolutely.
Yeah. Does Injustice 2 still do that?
It does exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they've also got, not branching campaign is not quite the right word for it, but you will go into some cutscenes where you've got two superheroes and two bad guys, and then you get to pick which one you want to use.
Mm-hmm.
And I can spoil this game, right? This is 2017.
Look, yeah.
No. I mean, it's spoilers. 2.5 years spoilers. Old.
Batman's Bruce Wayne, warning. We know.
No, well, near the very, very end of the game, because Batman and Superman are on opposite sides, like up until then, you're picking various characters that you can at certain checkpoints in the cutscene, like select the hero that you want to fight. So, you know, Blue Beetle and Firestorm, they're standing next to each other. They're there to defend something. So you're like, one of the guys will be like, oh, take this fight. And then you pick the one you want, but it's inconsequential. It's just you get to pick. You have a choice of picking characters. Mm-hmm. Near the end of the story, as Batman and Superman come to a head, there's actually a point in the story where you have to pick sides. So, like, at this point in the story, are you picking Superman to side with him, or are you picking Batman to side with? Like, they literally fight each other, and there is an alternative ending.
Who did you side with, Ken?
No, Batman. Of course.
I'm not saying it's the wrong choice.
No, it is. No, you're not saying it's the wrong choice. I'm telling you it's the right choice. I'm telling you it's the right choice.
Yeah.
But that's where it's interesting. So there's actually a campaign with this fighting game, and, you know, but I might be done with it because there's a lot more grinding. Like, after you play the story campaign, there is this whole other sort of loot system where you have to level up each individual fighter to then equip those items that you pick up in loot boxes. I played through the campaign and all my characters are about level 1 or 2. And the game rewards you with loot. And I've got a couple of level 20 pieces. And I'm like, I need to level up each individual fighter to level 20 to equip that loot, that particular loot. It takes about 5 fights. It took me about 5 fights to go from level 2 to level 4. So I'm like, I'm not sure if I've got that number of fights to level up to grind all the way to level 20. But
and you wouldn't do it. And the question is, would you only do it for a couple because, hey, you happen to have the loot, or would you do it for all of them just to feel like you'd completed something?
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I really enjoyed what I played. I'm glad that my local library has got a selection of PS4 games that I can pick and borrow. Enjoyed what I played. I've got 3 more weeks on this particular loan, so I might just pop it in every so often and give it a few rounds. But it's been good and really enjoyed it. And I guess on that note, we'll quickly take a break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about the topic of this episode, which I had missed out at the very top of the show in terms of the introduction. When we come back, we'll be talking about fear of missing out. And we are back. For the discussion topic this week, we're going to be talking about fear of missing out. Missing out on being part of the latest conversations on Twitter about a particular game. Missing out on day one midnight launches. Missing out on being part of the zeitgeist and not having the retweeted hot takes. Not leading the conversation about anything, and just sometimes being caught up in the hype of all of that stuff. And this is particularly pertinent for people who are in the media or in the video games media or talk about video games or just enjoy the hobby. It seems that so much about this hobby is about the newest, the latest, the greatest, and there is always FOMO just lurking behind it. Steven, do you suffer from FOMO?
I think I used to quite a bit. I think it's curbed as I've gotten older. Occasionally, I still get pangs of it, and it can, I guess, manifest in different ways. So, for example, I bought Fire Emblem Three Houses and I bought Astral Chain, and I probably really don't have the time to play either of those, but they were just too good to pass up. How could I possibly miss out on these amazing experiences? Control is another one, but again, that's a little bit more manageable at 15 to 20 hours, and that was another one that was not on my radar, but as soon as I had a look at what it was about, and I was like, I didn't want to miss out on that experience, or at least I didn't want to have to wait for that experience. I know. I guess FOMO in gaming is obviously it's technology driven because the whole industry is in some ways technology driven. So there's people who always have to have the latest graphics card. They've always got to have the highest settings on every game they play. They've got to update to the latest firmware. You've got to download the latest patch. You've got to have the latest software. You've got to be on topic, on trend, and be able to wax lyrical about whatever the newest game is. And part of that is the media. How much does games, media, and PR push that as well? Because obviously, the hot takes get the hot clicks. So, we need to be there with our finger on the pulse, getting eyes on content. And I think, again, it's something that probably affected me more when I was younger. I think it works less on me now, partially because in previous years, and we've discussed this before, Ken, I've wasted quite a lot of money on games that I never got around to playing. And games prices drop fairly rapidly, and with services like Game Pass, it's becoming less and less of, something that I need to spend a lot of money on straight away when realistically, even if I wait 4 to 6 to 8 weeks or longer, I probably wasn't going to play that game much or finish it in that time span anyway. So, I think that's one of the things that my FOMO has lessened, as well as probably being more comfortable within myself and knowing more what I like and what I don't like, and being mature and realistic about not just budgeting financially, but also time, because as we can probably all attest, as you get older and as you have children, money is not my concern. Time is my concern. I got the money. I don't have either.
Oh dear.
Hence the 7-day rentals. We know, but
I mean, there is. But I mean, there is. We the three of us have briefly talked about it, you know, in the break as well. Just real life obstacles and constraints do factor into this, especially in, I think, our three lives. Fire Emblem Three Houses was the perfect example.
I know.
I was so, like, everybody on Twitter was talking about it, and every podcast I listened to was talking about it, and it was all this, and Fire Emblem is one of those sort of franchises that used to be sort of obscure, but sort of moved into the mainstream was it Path of Radiance?
Yeah. I think Awakening on the 3DS was the one that really kicked it off. That was apparently supposed to be the last entry, and it did so well that they thought
they struck gold with that.
They struck gold, and so they kept doing it on the handheld. Because, Path of Radiance and Radiant Dawn were console-based titles. A lot of the stuff before that had been handheld for a while. Yeah. There was GBA titles before that.
But it was gathering all this momentum. It was like, you know, Fire Emblem, Fire Emblem, Fire Emblem. You know, like people started talking about that more and more and more. And I hear like Awakening and Path of Radiance and all of that stuff. And then Three Houses hit. There was this crescendo of like everybody freaking out about Three Houses. And I got caught up in it. I'm like looking at everybody. And I didn't buy it in the end because real world constraints. Real world constraints means I have very little money at this point to splurge on games now. So it was just holding back that restraint. It was so difficult. And everybody was talking about it, and everybody had thoughts on it, and everybody had... Which house were you picking? Were you the Blue Eagle? Black Lion? Whatever. And everybody had...
You're doing good.
Close, keep going.
There's a golden guinea pig as well.
There's a golden
guinea pig or something. Yeah, and there's
golden
like
platypus.
Platypus. That's it. Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, that's the one. The Australian edition, Ken.
Localization is important, Ken.
And there's Ravenclaw and Hufflepuff.
We don't want anyone suing us now, Ken. Let's just...
I was the same with Three Houses because I sat there and for me, the whole FOMO thing, like, firstly with games now... We talked before about, you know, your EB renting habits. And look, it's not uncommon. A lot of people do it. But for me, looking at games, my big question for me is, do I buy a physical copy or do I buy it digitally? And that is when I say to myself, okay, I'm going to buy something digitally. That's when I'm committed. I've got to get this game done. Now, everybody's going to laugh when I say that I've played 60 hours of Fire Emblem Three Houses and I have only just gotten after the time skip because I'm a jerk and I take forever.
See, I don't even, there's a time I don't even skip. Know about a time
there's
skip.
There's a time
That's
skip
how, like,
and they grow up.
Toe in the water
and
I am.
They all look really amazing and stuff and they look like Skittles Taste the Rainbow. So that basically their outfits usually match their hair.
Okay.
It's weird. But it's like for me, that's how I measure my commitment to a game now. Because if I'm buying a physical copy, it's my way of saying, it's usually my way of kind of saying to myself, I think I'm caught up in this purely for the hype. Mm-hmm. And I have the option to cancel the pre-order or to return it or to sell it if... I never get to that point of that interest really peaking any further and it's savored enough by social media and all that. If it's digital, I'm 210% committed to playing that game, completing that game, and I don't care how long it takes and I don't care when I do it.
More generally though, do you think like the hobby is predicated on that fear of missing out, like everything? So it's pre-orders, it's pre-order bonuses, it's day one launches, day one editions, early access, and it's not
editions.
Just about games, like movies, like all the Marvel movies, Star Wars movies, you want to be there day of, midnight screenings.
I think it lets people feel relevant.
It's the power. It's a power dynamic of you have information that other people may not have yet. Like a majority of the Avengers and the Marvel movies were released here earlier than what they were in the States. And I remember when the Avengers came out originally, I was writing for a different website at that time, which no longer exists, and I remember the people I was riding with, they were sitting there and they were spitting that we got to see the Avengers first, and they couldn't understand why. But it was like this little brief moment that, you know, I had this element of knowledge and power and authority on something that purely by circumstance they could not. And we've talked about now social media, meaning that it is easier to infer that authority, but it's also easier to, I guess, not just find inclusion, but also promote exclusion, which is where I guess that FOMO component comes from.
I guess it's no different to, you know, back in the day where if you weren't up with whatever sitcom everyone was watching the night before at work, you'd feel a little bit left out around the lunch table because they'd all be talking about it and you'd be sitting there with nothing.
But that
to
was
add.
A finite moment in time within a certain community. Now,
yeah, and
now community is measured globally for that sort of thing. And that's where the that feeling, yeah.
So it just magnifies
that feeling. It does, because you feel smaller and more inconsequential.
Everybody, yes. Everybody yeah. is doing this.
And look, it's hard, and it sometimes infuriates me when I see people who are posting that, you know, oh, I'm getting this and then I'm playing that and, oh, I've ordered this and look, I've ordered these three things because I saw it on Nintendo Direct. I'm so super hyped for it. And I'm sitting here going, I would, like, by circumstance or for whatever reason, I think a lot of people would be happy to just commit to and get through one, you know, and feel like they'd gotten through something.
But again, yeah. that used to be me.
I used to order
everything, and most things on my shelf weren't completed. And I think it was, do you ever get the feeling like that you're searching for a game or the idea of a game? So you keep buying all of these games thinking that this is going to be the one. This is going to be the game that is going to be exactly what I need right now and what I need it to be, and I'll stick with it. And then you get a few hours in and you see another game and that's the new hotness, and you're like, this will be the one. This is going to be the one that's going to, you know, finally kick me into overdrive. I'm going to stick with it the whole way through and I won't buy any other games until I finish this one.
To put it simply, yes. And for me, that comes particularly with JRPGs. I say to myself, I'm buying this and I want to feel committed to the world. I want to feel committed to the lore, and I may not get a full, I've explored everything, but I want to feel the satisfaction of completing it. And, you know, it's hard to do that now, admittedly, for obvious reasons, but also do you guys get the sense that you buy the game not with an intention to complete it? You buy it so that you can have the flavor of it and the sense of it purely to participate in the conversation, and that's the only reason why it's sitting there.
I think it depends on how much it costs. I think if I'm paying like full retail price, me being an idiot is absolutely going in thinking, I'm going to finish this game. I used to be the person who would buy the season pass before I'd even started the game. Mm. Like, I just had to have it.
And now you don't.
And, you know, many times that had come back to bite me, because by the time I got the end of the game, I'm like, I just want to see the arse end of this thing. I don't want to touch any of these DLC missions. I wish I'd never.
Well, there's something. I mean, there is one specific game that I definitely bought just because I wanted to be part of that, part of the conversation, just to be able to, I guess, show off. And that game was Vanquish.
Oh gosh, that was a while.
Oh, cult
classic, cult, you know, classic. Like, it's Vanquish. A platinum game, platinum game, and everybody.
Well, that's your cred game.
Yeah,
Ken.
No,
like,
absolutely.
That
was
cred.
Pretty much the entire reason why I bought it. So what happened was, it was a whole confluence of things. You know, the demo had come out. People had really enjoyed it. There was this whole knee slide and a gun shooty thing. And it's like super over the top anime. And it's platinum. And I think at that point, Vanquish had only just published Bayonetta. Like, it was around that time when platinum was really like cool. And
the hip new kid on the scene.
And Vanquish was getting some good buzz, and I was on holiday in Hong Kong, and I wanted to, like, this is how sort of shallow the whole thought process is, and it's like, I am in a foreign, different country. I'm in a foreign country, and I've got a copy of Vanquish, which has got Chinese words on it because it was the Asian version. And I took a snap of it. I posted it up on Twitter just so that I could say that, look at what I've got. Like, look at this kind of cool game, but it's kind of off kilter because it was slightly like 3% different from everybody else's copy. Because everybody else had just had English words, and mine had English words and Chinese words. And I brought that game home to Melbourne, and that game remained sealed in its box up until like just a month ago when I sold out when I got rid of all my Xbox games. Like, it was still in its plastic wrap. Like, I hadn't even unwrapped it.
I will confess, I bought Super Mario Odyssey because I sat there and thought to myself, I don't think I'm going to get through it. I don't really have an interest in getting through it. But I want to be able to be part of the conversation, be part of I've sampled it, and I get a little bit of the hype, and that is enough for me. And that is an absolutely ridiculous, stupid reason to be buying a game.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yes, but I did it, and then I returned it. Yeah,
it makes me think of something that Jason said once about Persona 5. He said that Persona 5 is a game he wishes he had finished but has no desire to play.
Yeah,
like, I really wish I'd finished that, but I don't want to play it. I just want to be able to maybe weigh in or just have that experience. And I think a lot of games are like that for me nowadays, especially because my bread and butter growing up was JRPGs, and I just don't have the time for them anymore. And the Switch lulls you into a false sense of security, thinking you're going to have all this time to play JRPGs. So that's why I bought Astral Chain and Fire Emblem Three Houses, and that's why I'm buying Dragon Quest XI again, because, you know, I didn't have time to play it on the PS4, but I'll find it on the Switch somehow.
I bought it on the PS4 digitally. I'm still buying a physical copy of the Switch version. I don't know why. I do not know why I'm doing it, but I feel compelled that I will be able to. And that's the thing. Like, I think a lot of the decisions I've been making recently have been mainly on the Switch because it feels more comfortable to me. It feels like a component of me. I don't feel like, you know, it kind of caters to my identity a little bit more of, I can take it down to the cafe for 45 minutes and have my toasted chicken and cheese sandwich. And, yeah, it fits into the gaps. And I can turn it – I can just press, you know, press the menu button, go into sleep mode, and know I can come back to where I was later. And that works fine. And that's the reason why it took me 60 hours to get through the first component of Fire Emblem 3 Houses with one house. Right. I mean, we've gone through all 3 houses, yeah.
On the flip side of FOMO, then, do you think, like, what is the value, or where is the sort of tantalizing little tidbit, hook, bait, that about coming to a game late, coming to a thing that is...
I think there's a few things. Again, one is tied to performance. Generally, the longer you wait, there'll be performance patches and updates and add-ons and definitive editions and remasters these other things.
Yeah.
So I think that can be part of it. So for example, if you picked up Shadow of the Colossus for the first time on the PS4, what did you really miss out on apart from a game that ran fairly poorly on the PlayStation 2, all things considered.
And I think it's... Yeah, I mean, like, I get the idea of it's nice to come to a game late knowing that you can enjoy it on your own terms, but also knowing that when you want to sit and you want to kind of sit and express your happiness or your disdain for a part of the game, you know that there's an already built community who are going to sit there and go, yep, I know exactly what you mean. And there's still an element of you can still be part of – it's not so much a dialogue. It's more of a reflection and camaraderie at that point, and less of a dialogue sort of between a bunch of people doing it all at the same time. It has a different feeling to it. So, you know, like it's – My favorite game of all time, which I probably have said quite often, is Super Mario World 2. I love it. Yoshi's Island was, but it, you know, and being able to sit there and say to people, or even today, there was someone on Twitter who sat and went, I've just noticed that in the remaster that's come out on, you know, the Switch online subscription, that those little coins look a little bit more orange because they're red coins. And I'm like, yes, I remember that, but I remember when I was on the Super Nintendo and I was 9 years old, or was it 10? I don't know, one or two. I remember that. And I could still sit there and kind of go, yes, you've got some, you know, even though you're coming to this, God knows how many years late, yes, you've got some camaraderie. I hear what you're saying. And yes, I completely agree with you. And I want you to feel like you haven't missed out on anything because it was the exact same experience that you're having now. In a way,
I think it can be difficult as well. Again, so much of gaming is building on things that came before, to a degree that going back to some titles means that you really might not see what was so special about them at the time. So obviously one of the benefits is you get out of that hype cycle. So 6 months, 12 months down the line, the dust has settled and people come to, you know, a pretty solid, I guess, agreement as to where that game fell. Once all the hype has died and people can be a bit more critical, you know, like you might say, oh, actually, I guess it was more of an average game than really great. Or maybe it was really great in the moment, but upon reflection, it wasn't really good. And then you got things like, I played Half-Life 2 extremely late, like years after it came out, to the point that I'd played games that it had influenced, and I didn't enjoy that game, and I honestly couldn't understand how anyone could think it was one of the greatest games ever made. And I think it's because I didn't play it at release.
Mm. Which is...
And I think that's can have a big impact with particular titles.
Well, absolutely, for titles which are regarded as milestone titles, like these are points in time, like seminal points in time. Mm. And if you weren't there at that time, it just wouldn't make any sense. Like you could, like, I can appreciate something like Command and Conquer Red Alert 2, like, but I couldn't go back to that now. Like if I were to come into it now, be like, ugh. That's not great, guys. But you know, being part of that conversation then when everybody was mad about Red Alert 2, you know, like
it's like Dragon Quest 1-3 coming out on Switch the same day as Dragon Quest 11, and my mind boggles that people are excited about that.
Back up, yeah. I'm far behind. Dragon Quest 1-3 are coming out on Switch the same day as Dragon Quest. Okay, this is how far behind I am. Jesus, Tap Dancing Christ. Okay.
But I know that's something you'll be on board with, Ken, because I think people by now should be well aware of your opinions on old games versus terrible. New games.
End discussion.
Well, it's this is where it's
okay. So here's a philosophical question. Do you define an old game purely based on its graphical components, or is it already getting old the day after it's been released, and it's therefore the it's gradually getting terrible?
It's gradually getting more and more terrible.
Okay.
It's like it is devalued the moment it gets out of the lot.
So are you basically saying that if a person decided not to get a game at launch, by the time they get it, that you, like, for you, if you didn't get that at launch, and like if you didn't get, say, Three Houses at launch, and you decide to wait until Christmas for whatever reason, and you go out at Christmas, but it's, you'll sit there and go, why'd you get this for me for Christmas? It's terrible. It's an old game. What
the heck? No, it's not quite. It's not quite as cutthroat and mercenary as that. It's just, it's more of a. New games are great. We're always looking forward. Games grow and build upon things that came before it.
Yeah.
And I can appreciate a game's sort of place in history. But if, say, I've never played Shadow of the Colossus, mm-hmm. I've never played any of the Uncharteds, I never played Last of Us, I can appreciate those games' place in history, and I can appreciate what it does to the medium, but my appreciation of the medium is not dependent on me having to go back and actually play those again. I don't actually need I don't need to have my personal experience of those games to appreciate its place. So I don't feel compelled to, like, if I said, told somebody, oh, I've never played Uncharted, they'd be like, oh my god, you gotta go. It's like, no, not really. I don't need to try it. Like, I don't feel any any compulsion to go and play this old game. Like, yes, it was important. Yes, it's important to people. Yes, it was a departure from all the other games in its time, and therefore has its place in history. But I myself do not need to experience that to appreciate its place.
Yeah. Look, I was the same with, admittedly, the Witcher 3. I kind of sat there and went, I recognize that this is, you know, this is a good game for its time. Yeah. It did a lot of stuff with, you know, that a game like Dragon Age Inquisition didn't do in the same way, and it did it really, really well. I can appreciate that, but I don't have to play it to appreciate that. And that's, I guess... It comes back to the role of people who are in the games media, that there seems to be this expectation that to qualify for that kind of identity is based on quantity rather than discerning what you believe is quality.
Well, it's absolutely, and there is a sort of almost an expectation for people in the games media to have to like everything about everything.
Really?
Like,
I think not everything. There are certain personalities who cultivate a sort of like an idea about themselves. So, someone like Jason Schreier is obviously he's a JRPG guy. He's who I'd go to if I want info on a JRPG. Someone like James Swinbanks.
Driver. Driving game.
Racing game.
About a racing game. I'm probably going to ask.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Ask James. And I think that's something you can do when you get to a level, certain level. But I think there is probably pressure on some people to have that sort of jack of all trades approach where you can offer up a comment on any game, despite the fact that you may have
and this is the interesting thing, because you just brought up something very interesting. You are identifying writers, you know, whose work that you respect, but their longevity in what they've written has facilitated them to reduce their scope of games and essentially hone their expertise. However, people who starting out, or who write more as a hobby, or who engage in the community more as a hobby, there's more of a need of, you need to know about this, and it feels a lot more scattershot. And look, honestly, that was something, and I will tell you, in the past year, there has been a lot of good stuff that has come out, and I have played none of it.
Oh, no, same.
None. And for very, very good reasons. But, like, if I, you know, if daughter was not in the picture, I might have. But it would have, I think, you know, over the past, you know, 10 to 12 months, I guess, being able to take that step back, although difficult because it seems counter to what the expectation is of the community, that you have to be engaged and you have to be part of the dialogue.
Mm.
It's, I mean, I'm in the same boat as Stevens, making me appreciate that I choose things that I either know I'm going to finish or I have a clear expectation that I will. And I appreciate and respect the dialogue that people are having about other games and kind of recognize, okay, so this is what they're thinking, and kind of just seeing their opinions from the periphery in a way. But right. No, I completely – it's – I agree. It is frustrating to kind of see that, you know, people who write more, people who have a certain voice in the community can start to be – more niche and more specialized, and it would be nice to feel as if you could be part of a community without needing to
build up your geek cred. I mean, Stephen, you talked about it a little bit, and there is sort of still this gatekeeping mentality. Mm. Like, you don't have enough geek cred. Oh, you've never played X, like, you can't talk about why you've never played X.
And I think that's down to a few things. One, how confident we are in ourselves, how much we value the opinions of others, and I guess ultimately how much you care about any of that stuff. Like, does it really matter at the end of the day? Like, do you need to justify to someone else that you qualify as a gamer through the fact that you bluff your way past some questions or their opinions on a game that you sunk 3 hours into because you've got a Whitman sampler of games in front of you? You can't possibly put any decent amount of time into all of them, so you just sort of skim over, or you're just regurgitating opinions that you read somewhere else and passing them off as your own. Like, I think it's a whole range of things. I think it really just comes down to you being comfortable in yourself and just going, I'm not actually that interested in that, or knowing that it's a good game, but knowing that it's not for you. Like, one of my examples is Monster Hunter. For countless years, I tried to get into Monster Hunter, and Monster Hunter World looked like it was going to be the one that was going to do it for me, and I played it at PAX, and I was like, yep, I like this, and I just didn't have the time. And it's sort of gone past me now. Iceborne is out, and it's gone.
That's interesting, because this brings up another time mentality. No, we've been talking originally about a whole lot of games which are we take them, we go play them, and it's nice and we have that experience on our own, and we might dialogue with a few people about what we're experiencing. That's about it. The whole gamers live service thing is a whole other ball game of if you don't keep...
Just straight up manipulation. Yeah, like, that's all that is. That's literally just keeping you on the hook.
An Xbox so that we
first
can play
taste
Destiny
is free,
2
my
together.
Friend.
And I can tell you, we're not playing Destiny 2 together at the moment, and we've sat for the last 6 months and told ourselves we'll get Borderlands 3 because then there'll be a game that we could play together at something. It's a type of game, an FPS that my brother would like, has a sense of humor that I would like. And, you know, the game was released last week, and my brother, you know, gets me on the phone and he says, are we still planning on getting that? And I went, well, let's just wait until Christmas. You know, it doesn't seem to be a rush to do it. And it's the first time that, you know, it's the first time I've seen him pause to do it. He bought Anthem on launch.
Oh, yeah.
So. I told him not to. I sat and said, mate. and he's like, but all my friends are playing it and I want to be part of, you know, I want to be playing that with my friends and I want to be doing that. And then, you know, so, you know, it was...
Is that all FOMO is, wanting to be connected and relevant?
It's wanting to be connected and relevant and feeling that level of inferiority a lot more based on the scale of dissonant voices that we get now through being more interconnected for longer periods of time with people from greater distances and different cultures that appreciate different things to what we do.
And on that note of breaking the formula, I think we should round up and close off this episode. Thank you very much to you, Sarah and Stephen, for joining me on today's episode. Where can people find you, Sarah, on the internet? And do you have anything to plug?
Yeah, I have my Children Water review that I'm plugging, which is going to be going out. Woo! Aside from that, you'll find me on Twitter at Esoteric. And some people have been either delightful or slightly delusional that I'm going to be on a PAX panel at Penny Arcade Expo Australia in October. They put me on the Geek Parenting panel. Let's all be very afraid. Because a lot
sounds pretty reasonable.
Oh yeah, 10-month-old. We're totally getting her into the Pokemon already, man. Really, totally. Yeah. but yeah, so it's been the first time in about 2 or 3 years that I've gone to PAX, and I'm absolutely looking forward to it, and I'm looking forward to just being in the environment and seeing the buzz for a good couple of days, and then getting back to my regular geek mum life.
Yeah. Nice. Stephen, where can people find you on the internet, and do you have anything to plug?
Gorath44000 on Twitter. You can find me hanging around Player 2, occasionally doing news. I'm putting together our indie showcase coverage very slowly at the moment in the lead up to PAX Oz, so that should be going up on the site in the week or so leading up to PAX, and then you'll probably catch me hanging around PAX Oz pestering developers and hoping to sequester myself in the media room this year with Paul James to knuckle down and get some work done, because Lord knows my coverage last year was slim to none.
Well, that's good to know that you've got plans for PAX Australia. I myself will not be at PAX Australia this year. I decided to give it a miss because I've got a second child that needs... It'll be unfair for my wife to be looking after two children while I go gallivanting for the entire weekend. But you can find me on Twitter at Pixel Hunt, and you can find my most recent Player 2 plays, which is Rebel Galaxy Outlaw, on the Player 2 website. Remember to follow the Player 2 Twitter account. Come to the website. We've got news, articles, features, videos, podcasts, all of that good stuff. Follow us on Twitter at Player2 AU, and come visit the website at player2.net.au. And with that, we're out. Thank you very much for joining me on this episode of the Pixelcast, episode number 18. Bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Nice. And we are out.